Let's get into Jonah, shall we? The book of Jonah. It is tucked in your Old Testament. It is a small book, kind of buried in the Old Testament, but it is one of the most famous stories, not just of the Bible, but one of the most famous stories ever in the history of humankind. And there's a reason why it is so popular. It is so popular because it is such an extraordinary story of everything being the opposite and everything exaggerated. It is really a satire. If you understand the book of Jonah, when it was written in the ancient Near East 2,700 years ago, if you look at it through that lens, it is really a hysterically funny story. Now, you might not read Jonah and laugh out loud. You might not have heard it in Sunday school and cracked a smile. But it is a funny story because in the ancient Near East, humor is defined as the exact opposite or a huge exaggeration, right? Just think of the teaching of Jesus. When Jesus said, hey, if your right hand causes you to stumble, cut it off, everybody would be laughing. We read it and we take it seriously. What do you mean by that? Wow, sin is really serious. Jesus is just making a funny point that if there's something going on in your life, you know, that you need to get rid of, get rid of it. He's just making a simple point in a funny way. Jonah is making a simple point in a funny way. Everything in the story of Jonah is exactly the opposite of what it should be. And every paragraph in the story of Jonah is a massive, unexpected exaggeration. All intended to drive home a point. To drive home a point in a way that sticks with you. And that's what stories do. Some of you know of Aesop's tales, right? This is 2,500 years ago. He's a Greek writer writing these tales that stick with us even today. Have you heard of the boy who cried wolf? We all know that story, right? Well, it's an Aesop fable from 3,000 years ago nearly, right? A funny story with a serious point. Don't play with people's fears or it'll come back to bite you. We all know that story. Then there's a story of the tortoise and the hare, an Aesop fable. A funny story with a serious point. Slow and steady what? When is it? We all know it. 2,500 years ago, fable, right? I read another of Aesop's fables. I love it. The milkmaid and her pail. A woman was carrying a pail of milk to the market to sell. While daydreaming, she spills the milk. What was she daydreaming about? Well, she was daydreaming about how wonderful she would look in the new dress she would buy after selling her chickens, which will hatch from the eggs she would buy from the money she made. From what? The milk that she spilled. There's a spilled milk phrase in there. There is also a don't count your chickens before you hatch, right? All of these come from stories, right? Stories are powerful tools to change our lives. Psychology Today did a whole write-up on the power of story. This was one of their conclusions. Telling stories is the best way to teach, to persuade, to understand ourselves, and to understand the world around us. Jonah is such a story. Jonah reveals how the merciful heart of God is quite different from the vengeful heart of man. That's what the whole story is about. Comparing the merciful heart of God to the vengeful heart of man. It does it in a funny way, a satirical way, where everything is the opposite and everything is exaggerated. To recap quickly, this is about the God of Israel that cares for the enemies of Israel, Nineveh. Just preposterous. A prophet of God who disobeys God. Again, everything's upside down here. Jonah was sent east but goes west. Godless sailors turn to God. Just unthinkable, right? A man is swallowed by a fish and lives. That's funny. An evil city turns to God. Again, exaggerated, preposterous. A city that deserves wrath was given grace. And a man of God despises the grace of God. Everything is opposite. Everything is upside down. It's done in an ancient Near Eastern satire, but the point is clear. The point is clear. The moral of the story is clear to this very day. Those who appear to be the most godly often have the most trouble showing the mercy of God. That's the moral of the story. The moral of the story is not that God does miracles by saving a man in the belly of a whale for 3 days. That is not the moral of the story. If we posture it as a story about Jonah or about Nineveh or about the whale or about the 3 days in the whale, we've missed the point. The point of the story is those who appear to be the most godly often have the most trouble showing the mercy of God. And so the theme throughout our remaining 4 weeks of Jonah is going to be this: be more like Jesus and less like Jonah. Jesus is the antimatter of Jonah, right? Jonah was called to bring the mercy of God to the least, the last, and the lost, but went the other way. Jesus came as the prophet of God and willingly went to Nineveh, to the ends of the earth, to show the mercy of God to everyone, everywhere. Verse 1, chapter 1, the word of the Lord came to Jonah. If we're going to understand the story, we have to understand who Jonah is. Now, Jonah, biblically, was a real prophet. So this, he wasn't a made-up character in this story. He was a real prophet. The Bible references Jonah once or twice as a prophet who lived during the time of Jeroboam II, King Jeroboam II. He was a man of status. Prophets during this time were received by Israel. There were times where prophets were killed by Israel, but during this era, prophets were received by Israel. Jonah was a man of wealth. He could afford, at a moment's notice, to buy a ticket on a boat from Joppa to Tarshish, the other side of the world, 2,500 miles. Only an opulently wealthy individual could buy a ticket like that. Jonah was a man of status, a man of wealth, from a prosperous nation. Israel, during the time of Jonah, Jeroboam II, was a prosperous 10 tribes of the north. They had political freedom, they had trade routes that they were profiting from, they were a prosperous nation. They were also a proud nation. The nation of Israel is proud. They've always been proud. They're proud to this day, and for good reason, right? They're one of the oldest civilizations that have continued to exist through some fierce opposition and persecution. They've always had that story, that narrative. We are the proud ones. We are the people of God, chosen by God. Jonah also lived in a religious nation. They had the Bible. They had their Old Testament. They had the Torah, the first five books of the Bible. They had their law. They had their Ten Commandments. They had their traditions of Passover and of circumcision. They had their diets. They had all of the religious rules and regulations that set them apart. They were a proud and religious nation. You think we could draw some parallels between Israel and the United States today? A lot of them. So even though Jonah was written 2,700 years ago, we can see a lot of parallels between Israel and the United States. We are prosperous. We're a prosperous nation. I want to show you a couple of charts. This chart represents all the peoples of the world by their annual income. The people on the far left make $100 a year. The people on the far right make $60,000 a year. So this is all plotted by annual income. Next slide is the poverty line in the United States of America. That means that our poverty line is the top 3% of the wealth of the world. 97% of the world lives under the American poverty line. Next slide. This is the U.S. minimum governmental assistance, which means every unemployed family makes at least that much. That's 90% of the world living below the minimum governmental assistance plans. Next slide is just stark, right? Everybody to the left of that line is living under the United States minimum governmental assistance. We are a prosperous nation. Not to say it's fun being poor in America, don't get me wrong. I'm just saying, relatively speaking, we are a prosperous nation. We're a proud nation. We love our country for good reason. I don't care if you're Republican, Democrat, whatever your political party, we love America. We love what we stand for. We love our freedom. We love our prosperity. We love our narrative. We are proud Americans. And we're also religious Americans. Still, in our largely post-church culture, 75% of Americans claim a Christian heritage at the very least. 92% of Americans believe in God and have a relationship with God. So we're still very much a religious nation. So Israel and America now has a parallel. Israel during the time of Jonah and America, prosperous, proud, and religious. Now what happens when we have a lot going for us is we tend to be puffed up. We tend to think, yeah, look at us. We've kind of got it going on, right? We're free, we're prosperous, we're religious, God is with us, God is blessing us. And the problem with that is when we have an us, look at us, that usually means we have a what? A them. That we look down on. When there's an us, there's a them. Sports has a them, right? March Madness. Some of us might have filled out our brackets. Anybody that is not in our bracket is a them, right? We want them to lose. We picked our winner's brackets. Everybody else is a them. I happen to be a USC fan, so I have to hate on UCLA. Sorry, it just comes with the territory. It's contractually bound by that. So I talked to a couple of gentlemen in the first service. They wear their UCLA gear, and it's like, sorry, we can have to be enemies. Doesn't matter. We have to be enemies. It's just the way it goes, right? If you're a Raiders fan, you have to hate the Chiefs. If you're a Chargers fan, the three of you have to hate the Raiders. If you're a decent human being, you have to hate the Patriots. There's just some things that have a them in sports. In political life, if you're a Democrat, you have to think the Republicans are dangerous. If you're a Republican, you have to think the Democrats are dangerous, and there are billions of dollars of political machinery making sure that's what you think. There's an us, there's a them. Unfortunately, culture still has a them. Now, we're working on this one. We are working on this one. We are working on this reality where culture is not that much of an us and them. But listen, there's some natural things that happen. We're raised in a certain culture, a certain ethnicity, a certain, you know, certain traditions that sort of populate who we are. And then we look at other cultures, they do things differently. They relate with each other differently. Their family life is different. Their perceptions are different. How they think is different. Their music is different. And just human nature kind of defaults to looking down on that. It's like the way I do things is comfortable, so it must be good. And the way they do things, I don't quite connect with, so it must not be that good. Now, again, we are working on this. We're trying and trying and trying to understand and appreciate and embrace other cultures and the differences there and learn back and forth, but it's still there. It's still there. Something that is not being worked on is the us and them of religion. You don't believe what I believe, therefore you're a heretic. You don't live like I do, therefore you're immoral. You aren't doing the things that I do with church, and so you're unfaithful. We're not even working on that. We're doubling down on the us and them of religion. So if you're at all a student of religion in America, you see bitter divisions and bitter rivalries, even within the Christian faith, lobbing barbs back and forth and just calling each other names because we want that tribal sense that, you know what, this is us and you are them. Jonah had a them. Jonah had a fierce them, and that was the city of Nineveh. And he had a lot of reasons to look down on them. I mean, that was the empire that years later utterly destroyed and wiped off the face of the earth, Israel, gone. Wiped off the face of the earth, 10 tribes gone. Only thing that remained were the two tribes, which was later taken over by Babylon. And so Jonah had a right to look down on Nineveh, their violence, their godlessness, the suffering that they inflicted. I referenced Nahum 3 last week. Let me read it word for word. This is the biblical description of Nineveh. That city of blood, full of lies, full of plunder, never without victims. Many casualties, piles of dead, bodies without number, people stumbling over the corpses, enslaving nations by her prostitution and peoples by her witchcraft. I mean, there's no holding back. Nineveh is ugly, brutal, barbaric, evil. So here's what God says to the great prophet Jonah. Go to the great city of Nineveh and preach against it because its wickedness has come before me. God sees the suffering. He sees the violence. And he says, Jonah, you're going to go. You're going to go and you are going to preach against them. But Jonah ran away from the Lord. Now, if Jonah looked down on Nineveh, why wouldn't he want to go and condemn Nineveh? Well, we find out later in chapter 4 why. Because God gave them mercy. And Jonah knew exactly what God was doing. God was saying, Jonah, go preach against them. But Jonah thought they're going to hear that God is against them. They're going to hear that their ways are evil and they have to turn. And they're going to turn and God's going to show them mercy. Jonah says, I want no part of that. I am out of here. I am gone. He ran away from the Lord, headed for Tarshish. He went down to Joppa where he found a ship bound for that port. After paying the fare, he went aboard and sailed for Tarshish to flee from the Lord. Now, as we go through this story, as you know, this is not about Jonah. It is not about Nineveh. It's not about the whale. It is about the world and God's heart for the world. Nineveh represents the world. Jonah represents us. That's really what we're studying this month. And so when we look at Nineveh, we're looking at God's heart for the world. And in Jonah, it's clear that God looks at the world full of people, a broken world full of people. People that God loves, even in arguably the most evil city that has ever existed, God says, I know they're broken, I know they're evil, but they're full of people made in my image, and yes, they're going sideways, and yes, they're choosing violence, and yes, they deserve to be stopped, they deserve full wrath and vengeance, but I'm not going to pour that on them because I love these people. Jonah 4:11 calls it a city of 120,000. Now, we think of a city of 120,000, and we think that's no big deal. That's Temecula. That's Marietta, right? That's a kind of mid-sized town, maybe even a small town. Back then, that was the largest city on the planet. 120,000 people would be like us saying Tokyo has 40 million people in it. It's like this massive, massive city. Nineveh was the largest city on the planet at the time. And God is making a point. It's full of people. So Jonah, don't just judge them. Don't just wish vengeance upon them. They're human beings made in my image. Care about them as I do. Jonah 1:2 says that the world is full of problems. God is not blind to the problems of this world. God is not blind to the pain and the suffering of this world. Jonah 1:2 calls Nineveh wicked. Jonah 3:8 calls Nineveh evil. So God sees their sin. He sees the pain. He sees the violence. He sees the injustice. He sees the suffering. So through God's perspective of Nineveh, we see that God sees a world full of problems, but also a broken world full of possibilities. In Jonah chapter 4, verse 11, God looks at Nineveh and he says, Jonah, listen, this is a great city. Yes, it is full of violence and injustice and needless suffering, but it is a great city. And if you study ancient Nineveh, you will see remarkable architecture, remarkable art, remarkable libraries, right? A remarkable civilization that happened to be a culture of empire and bloodthirstiness, right? Horrific evil. But God is saying, listen, there's such possibilities here in this city. If they would only turn from violence and empire and turn to good and humanitarianism, this great city could become even greater. This world is broken, but it is full of possibilities. But Jonah said, I don't care. I don't care about the people. I don't care about the possibilities. You say go east, I'm going west. And he went to Tarshish. So in order to understand Jonah, we have to understand who he was and understand Tarshish. Where is Tarshish? You taking notes? I have no idea. No idea. Nobody has a definite idea. It's not like you can go visit the ruins of Tarshish right now. There's just biblical evidence and historical evidence of where Tarshish might have been. What we know of Tarshish is that it was west. What we know of Tarshish is that it's really hard to say. I've been trying to say it all morning. We also know it was probably in the western coast of Spain. Let me show you a map of where it might be. This is the likely location. So Joppa is where Jonah started. He went west to Tarshish, likely through the Straits of Gibraltar, likely on a port city or an island west of Spain. And here's why we think that's where it's at. It was run by the people of Phoenicia, the Phoenicians. The Phoenicians were brilliant people. They were masters of the sea. And they also resided in Lebanon. Now, Lebanon has great cedar forests. So they would harvest the cedar. They would build incredible ships. They would own the seas. They would put the lumber on those ships, and they would go to Egypt and Greece, and they would trade lumber for art, for pottery, for fabric. They would then take that to Tarshish, and that would be their central trade base from Tarshish. They would take the pottery, art, and fabric to Western Europe, even to ancient Great Britain. They would take it down to West Africa, where they would trade that stuff for metal, gold, silver, tin. They would load that on their ships, take it back to Tarshish, trade it there, and then take the metals back to Egypt, to Greece, and to Israel, and they would make money upon money upon money because they owned the seas. They made profit on every trade, and they became incredibly wealthy global superpowers. That's Tarshish. It was a very small, very safe, very wealthy, very comfortable world. You see why the Bible calls out Tarshish. It's not about Tarshish. It's about people who are retreating from the world, retreating from the complexity of the world, retreating from the struggle and suffering of the world to take refuge in a smaller, more comfortable place. That's what the story is about. It's a story about us. It's a story about the choices we make every single day. Do we pursue Nineveh and engage Nineveh with all of its brokenness, with all of its suffering, with all of its complexities, or do we say, you know what, I'd rather pull a Jonah and I'd rather go to my small, safe, comfortable world? And listen, I understand the draw to small, safe, and comfortable. I mean, have you seen what's going on in the world today? It's not pretty. In a lot of ways, not just in Ukraine, but we're talking about the whole geopolitical landscape is very complicated. Our own culture has gone through one of the most complicated, you know, periods in a generation. This is a tough world, and I understand, hey, give me my job, give me my paycheck, give me my family, give me my friends, a little safe, comfortable group of friends, give me a safe, comfortable church, I'm gonna be so good in my Tarshish, right? So good, and I get it. But let's look at the example of Jonah. Jonah ignored the big, broken, complex world and retreated to the safety of a small, disconnected, comfortable world. It's so easy to do. It's so normal and so natural, right? So let's not beat each other up if that's kind of what we want to do. It's the normal course of human nature, really. So God is asking us to do something difficult, difficult. God is saying through the story of Jonah, don't retreat from this big, broken, complex world. Don't retreat to a small, isolated, even religious world. Engage this world I love. Love it like I do. Show this world mercy and grace to everyone, everywhere, and over time, this world will be transformed by the power of love. That's the message through Jonah. And this isn't just talking about the big geopolitical realities. This is talking about the things we do in our own lives, the daily decisions we make. You know, we come to church and we're all, you know, likely from some kind of Christian heritage, or we've discovered a relationship with God through Jesus Christ, and we're here and we have this common story. But now when we leave this church, are we going to go west to Tarshish, or are we gonna go east to Nineveh? How are we gonna live our lives? How are we gonna engage the world around us? It could be we decide to go to Nineveh by little acts of kindness all day, every day. Just little acts of kindness all day, every day, even and especially to strangers. Doing a good job for a boss who is a jerk. That's pursuing Nineveh. A kind word towards family members who may not be very kind to you. That's pursuing Nineveh. Befriending someone who is very unlike us culturally. That's pursuing Nineveh. Seeking to understand those who disagree with us politically or religiously. That's pursuing Nineveh. Forgiving someone who has wronged us, that's pursuing Nineveh. Those are the choices we make every day. Do we retreat to our Tarshish of small sameness, or do we engage this big, broken, complex world with grace and love? This is tough stuff. So be patient with yourself. And some of you might be wondering, well, what's the next step? We'll talk about that as we go here. What's the next step? What can I do to be a little more like Jesus and a little less like Jonah? Jonah ran away from the calling to engage a big, broken, complex world. He ran away from God's heart. But here's what I love about this book. Not only wanted to save Nineveh, but he wanted to save Jonah. Jonah was running away from God, miserable. In fact, one of the phrases in Jonah is, I want to die, I want to die, I want to die. I mean, over time, he's like, I get it, Jonah. You're miserable. So Jonah's pursuit of a small world made him miserable. So God isn't just interested in saving the big complex world. He's interested in saving Jonah, this miserable, religious, successful person who was just grumbling and complaining and griping. God says, I want to save you too, buddy. And he did. So in the boat, there's a storm, right? God's pursuing Jonah. Since the storm was getting worse all the time, the sailors asked Jonah, what should we do to you to stop the storm? They knew it was Jonah's fault, and Jonah knew it was his fault. Throw me into the sea, Jonah said, and it will become calm again. I know this terrible storm is all my fault. This is the imagery of Jonah. Jonah living in a terrible storm. And I've got to broaden this out a little bit. Listen, when the church gets judgmental and cranky, which happens all the time, it messes up everything for everybody, right? The sailors were experiencing a storm that Jonah caused, and so grumbly, negative, judgy religious peoples ruin it for everybody. And I have to believe, and this is kind of a core thread here at Rancho, I have to believe that if the larger church kind of got its act together to be more like Jesus and less like Jonah, this world would be a little less in trouble. Because we would be leading with the love of Jesus. In every small conversation, in every small decision, in every interaction, that would result in big global change to make this world a little more like heaven. The sailors picked up Jonah and threw him into the raging sea, and the storm stopped at once. The story of Jonah tells us a few things, but in particular, that God will do absolutely everything, everything to get his forgiving grace to everyone everywhere, including and especially those most undeserving of it. God's grace is relentless. Jonah was going this way. Nope, little U-turn, buddy. I'm doing everything we can to get my grace to everyone everywhere, including and especially those most undeserving of it. God's relentless grace reaches farther than we would ever imagine. That's loud and clear through Jonah, isn't it? God's relentless grace reaches farther than we would even like. Jonah was furious that the grace of God would extend to Nineveh. So many religious people sitting on so many judgmental perks. Are you kidding? The grace of God goes there? God's relentless grace reaches even to the them. Even to the them. So let me ask you a question. In your own heart, who is your them? Who is your them? Who are the ones that you tend to look down on? And for some, it's harsh judgment. Some of you, just in a moment of honesty, might be able to say, you know what? I really have a hard time with these people. I have a hard time with this lifestyle. I have a hard time with these choices. I have a hard time with this culture. I have a hard time, fill in the blank, whatever it is. Some of us are like, yep, I have a them and I gotta work on it. I talked to some people all morning, some in tears, like I have thems and I need to work. Some of us, we have to dig a little deeper, because we might have been working on things. We might have been working on being more loving and more kind and more gracious. But really think, who do you just have a hard time with? Could be a cultural disconnect. It could be, I don't know, just the way certain people are and you just can't connect with them. Where is your them? I realized this week I had a them. Early in the week, I was going into a grocery store and a van pulls up and a group of people get out of the van and set up shop to panhandle with their children with signs. And I was immediately furious because we have been working to with the city and countless partners to prevent homelessness. And this is the poster child of everything that is wrong. Using children to panhandle, and we know the systems that goes on behind the scenes. They're terrible, terribly abusive systems that go on behind the scenes of this group. And what I did in my soul level anger is I not only judged that scene, but I judged the culture from which they came. And I did it, did my grocery shopping, saw them coming in, saw them coming out. I was upset. I didn't realize that was a them until I finished prepping this message this week. And I thought, oh, buddy, how about this starts with you? Now, if things are going on that are wrong, call wrong, wrong, call abuse, abuse, fix it, prevent it, do whatever you can, but don't judge the whole thing. Separate the behaviors from the people. I'm still learning this. So half the messages that I preach here are to this guy, right? Who do we judge? Who do we look down on? Be honest with yourself. Do some thinking. On a geopolitical context, the them is the Russian military right now, right? I mean, just call it what it is. The Russian military is the enemy of the world right now. Virtually every civilization is looking at the brutality that's going on in Russia, and everybody is condemning and judging, and I would say rightfully so, right? That is pure evil. It is unprovoked. It is attacking innocent citizens. It is killing hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands, of children and women who are not picking up arms. It is unbelievably horrific, and we're seeing it every day. So there is a righteous indignation, a righteous anger. And it wasn't until late last night that I realized, you know what? That is pure Nineveh. The Kremlin is pure Nineveh. We talked about this a little bit last week, but it was on the head of a pin where last night I remembered something. I remembered that I met some of these people. I took several trips to Russia about 20 years ago in this area, on the border of the Ukraine and Russia. And I took our youth group there. Just so you're aware, we're not taking our youth group to Ukraine anytime soon. But we took multiple trips there. We were working with very troubled youth in the region and a lot of exciting things were going on. And I will never forget one evening, there's a 12-hour train ride from Moscow to Saratov. It's long, it's brutal, it's bumpy, it's noisy, and it's just packed with people. On this particular train ride, it was filled, I mean, front to back, side to side with Russian soldiers. And there was this very odd, very fun overnight experience where these Russian soldiers are wondering why there are a group of teenage Californians on their train. So you can imagine how weird this was. And this isn't too long after the fall of the Soviet Empire. So I'm sure most of those people hadn't even seen an American, let alone a California teenager. And so they're like, come on over here. And we all sat at their tables, and the amount of vodka, I'm telling you, I don't know how they live consuming that much vodka. We did not serve that much vodka to the kids. No, we didn't serve any to the kids. Vodka free, but they were pounding it for all of us. And they are absolutely hammered. And they are just asking us tons of questions about our lives and our priorities and where we come from and what California is like. And can you take me there? I will do anything to leave Russia and go to California. And we're learning about their lives and the villages that they came from and their families, their mom, their dad, their siblings. Some of them were married and some of them had kids. And we're learning about their lives and what they want to do with their life and all the careers and imaginations that they have about their future. That was 20 years ago on that train ride, the border of Ukraine and Russia. It just dawned on me literally last night that I had that experience 20 years ago. And so is it possible, may not be likely, but is it possible that now these soldiers are 40 years old and some of them might have stayed in the Russian military and stayed serving in that very area and could very well be in the fight? These are human beings. And I had to remind myself of that because yesterday, I was getting very, very deep into the horrors of this invasion. I mean, I got way too deep. I just knew this was kind of coming up, and I just read story after story, saw image after image of the most horrific violence in our generation. And it dawned on me that when I read yesterday that the fifth Russian general was killed, my immediate reaction was, well, good. And when a convoy of armored personnel carriers from the Russian side is obliterated, my first reaction is, well, good. But then when I think that, you know, I spent an overnight with these soldiers, I have to humanize it. And Jonah compels us to humanize even the worst of the them. They are human beings made in the image of God, not to justify or explain away anything. I'm hopeful that every time they move forward and assault, it is reluctantly, if I could just see the best in these people that I spent that evening with, to humanize them somehow, some way, and to say that is the Nineveh from a geopolitical point of view. And could the story of Jonah allow us to open up our heart even to them, as evil and horrific of people that they are, and what they're doing is unthinkable. And let me just say that last night I had a tough, tough night because I read so much of these stories and saw so many images. Last night I had dozens and dozens of nightmares. I didn't sleep last night. I had dozens of nightmares where I would, a nightmare of a shelling, and I would wake up and feel the impact. Have you had dreams like that? They're just so vivid and so real. I can remember them right now to the detail, to the micro detail. These dreams, these nightmares I had last night, I didn't get any sleep. I'm gonna crash as soon as I have some Mexican food after. I'm crashing. It was traumatic. I mean, I woke up with Jenny and just said, I'm feeling trauma, and I just had nightmares. Could you imagine these hundreds of thousands, millions of families that live this every single day of their life? Can you imagine that? And then to say, this is Nineveh, and is it possible for us to humanize even these invading forces and somehow balance, you know, the violence has to stop. It has to stop by any means. It has to stop. Yet these are people made in God's image that God loves, and God is not eager to pour vengeance on them any more than he was eager to pour vengeance on Nineveh. He wants to give them grace. So can we both call out evil and live in grace at the same time? Jesus did, and we have our guide.